Thank you very much for having me. Now, what do we have, about 3 hours? It's true that I could talk for a very long time about being in Israel and Palestine, and I'm happy for the opportunity to talk about it from more religious perspectives here this morning. I will try to avoid the political aspects, actually, but it's hard to do because the two are so intertwined in Israel. I'm going to tell you a little more about Tantour, where I spent 7 months, in a minute. But first I want to share a couple stories of that from my personal experience, and I bet many of you have similar experiences, sort of demonstrations of what I call the one right way gone wrong. When I was in my 20s, my sister Sue got married. We were raised Catholic. But she fell in love with a guy from a Mennonite community in Nebraska. And the Mennonites, as you may know, kind of share theology with Amish, but they went modern, unlike the Amish. But the communities were very close-knit, and my brother-in-law's, his was the first generation to really marry outside the community. My Aunt Charlotte, who was from a stiff Irish Catholic family, refused to come to the wedding, which is something, a hurt that my sister carries to this day. That's one story. The other story involves Donna Brazile. Some of you may know her. She's a political figure in our country, and she grew up in New Orleans, Catholic. She spoke at a conference that I attended once, and then she told this story about the night that Martin Luther King died. And the local Black Baptist church held a service, which she wanted to go to, and her mother forbid her to go to it because it was sinful for a Catholic to go into a Protestant church. She went anyway, and she got spanked for it. So that's just two examples, and I bet every one of you could cite many more of what I call the one right way gone wrong. When we think we know the one right way of religion, and I would submit that that's a lot of what's going on in Israel now, too. I called it the crossroads of many, many religions. Tantour was founded in 1972. It sits on a hill. The name itself means hill. If you remember, you may have seen women from places like Afghanistan and Tajikistan often wear these little tubular hats. That's called a tantour. So it really means it's on the top of a hill. And from a roof where we used to go from the dining room to watch the sunsets after dinner, we could look in one direction and we saw the checkpoint into the West Bank at Bethlehem, look the other direction and saw Jerusalem. And Tantour was founded as a result of the Vatican II deliberations. Pope Paul VI, who finished those deliberations after John the 23rd died, sought to heal a rift that was like 1,000 years old. When we talk about ecumenical, it's called Tantour Ecumenical Institute, but its mission is equally interfaith. But the ecumenical, when we think about ecumenical here in this country, we tend to think about Catholics, Unitarians, Baptists, Presbyterians, Episcopals, and so forth. But hundreds of years before that, the East and the Western Church split. And the Patriarch of Rome and the Patriarch of one of the Eastern Churches excommunicated each other. And that lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years. But at Vatican II, Paul VI invited one of the Eastern Patriarchs to come and observe that meeting. And the goal is Christian unity. Sometimes I ask, what is the point of Christian unity? What's wrong with diversity? But it's a thing with a lot of people to pray for and work toward Christian unity, or at least that we won't kill each other over our respective faiths anymore. So following Vatican II, Pope Paul VI and this Eastern prelate embraced and lifted the excommunications on each other, and talks between the East and West have been going on ever since. Not to any big effect that I could observe when I was there. They're still very separate. So when Tantour was built in the 70s, it was built on a a place where the Knights of Malta had had a hospital at the top of that hill. And it was situated between a Jewish neighborhood on one side called Gilo and an Arab neighborhood on the other side called Beit Safafa, which had both Palestinian Arabs, but both Christian and Muslim. So it was pretty clear from the very beginning that Tantour's mission had to include both interfaith as well as ecumenical efforts. When we think about the conflict in Israel-Palestine, and I'll just use the term Israel-Palestine here for want of a better inclusive term, we tend to say something like Islamic-Jewish conflict or Arab-Israeli conflict or Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And that is way, way, way too simple, especially when it comes to religion. There's a huge amount of intra-Jewish conflict. The ultra-Orthodox control a great deal of the religious life of the nation, but they don't regard people like the Reform Jews that are our friends right here at the Cape Cod Synagogue are not even considered as Jews by the ultra-Orthodox. There are modern Orthodox, there's conservative and Reform, and all these different, and totally secular. But to be a citizen of Israel, you have to declare a religion. And Judaism is one of those faiths that you can actually say I'm Jewish without practicing any religion. It's an interesting intersection of culture and religion. There's another interesting dynamic that goes on there about women. Now, I'll tell two stories about that. One, when I was going there in the 1990s managing study abroad programs, and there was an ultra-Orthodox rabbi who worked in our office. The director of our office there had hired him, and he was Haredi, I mean, the most ultra of ultra-Orthodox. And I certainly had my notions about the oppression of women in ultra-Orthodox communities and the rigidity of the religious practice. Well, we were working on an accreditation study and preparing for a visit of accreditors, and I learned to appreciate his intellect and his the way he approached problems, the way he so quickly understood what we had to do to be ready for this visit, and his sense of humor. He had a great sense of humor. And I sort of, you know, began to know somebody personally and had a much different idea about who the ultra-Orthodox were. But what really turned me around in my mind about the ultra-Orthodox was that he invited me and a colleague to his house for Shabbat dinner. Now that in itself is extraordinary. A woman who was not even Jewish, my colleague had married she was raised in an Orthodox Jewish family, but married a Puerto Rican guy, and her family sat shiva for her when that happened. In other words, they mourned her as if she were dead. It's something similar to what the Amish do when they shun people who leave the community. Well, he sent his daughters, they live in a neighborhood that puts up sawhorses at the entrances so that nobody will be scandalized by viewing cars driving. It's forbidden to drive cars on the Sabbath. And so he sent his daughters, he told us where to park by one of these sawhorses, and he sent his daughters to meet us, and we shared the Shabbat dinner in their home. And I will tell you, the home was, it was inescapable to see that it was suffused with love and faith. And, you know, I think I have pretty good antenna about seeing where women are oppressed, and I didn't get one whiff. The joy and love in the home was palpable. So it taught me something about being careful about making generalizations about people. The other very interesting thing going on in Israel right now is a group called the Women of the Wall. Actually, they were founded 30 years ago. And the Women of the Wall, led by a lawyer named Anat Hoffman, an Israeli woman, are trying to make it possible for women to pray at the Western Wall. How many of you have been in Israel? Some of you have. If you've probably been to the Western Wall, it's considered, believed to be the wall of the Second Temple. It's one of the holiest places in all of Judaism. And people go to pray there, put little prayer intentions in cracks in the wall, little notes. And the wall is divided. The men pray on one side of that divider, and the women pray on the other side. And police enforce that division. Also, the men have about two-thirds of that space, and the women have one-third. Well, Anat Hoffman, 30 years ago, started convening groups of women who wanted to pray together, who wanted to hold a Torah and dance and sing and pray with it, which is Jewish custom. But according to the ultra-Orthodox, women are not allowed to do that. And so they have Orthodox, Reform, and Conservative women across the Jewish spectrum who meet at the wall on the first day of each new month in the Jewish year, which is a lunar calendar, and pray. And when they first started, they had about 30 people would show up. Now 300 or 400 show up. And as a result of it becoming much more obvious, ultra-Orthodox also show up to protest. And by protest, I mean shouting and screaming and trying to drown out the women as they pray. At times, young teenage girls or ultra-Orthodox girls getting close enough to pull hair and spit, and sometimes chair throwing. I met a poet when I went there a few years ago that he and two other male colleagues, by prearrangement, handed a Torah over to the women on the morning of one of their prayer services. And the women took the Torah and started praying for it. You have to go through security when you go anywhere near the Western Wall, and they will search these women. The guards will search the women to make sure they don't have a Torah or they don't have religious garb. They're not allowed to wear what's called a tallit, a prayer shawl. So for 10 or 15 minutes, nobody really knew what had happened, but the women were dancing around with the Torah and praying. And when the men realized, the ultra-Orthodox men on the men's side of the divider realized what was going on, some of them went over to retrieve the Torah from these unholy hands, in their view, and others attacked the three men who handed it over, and two of them ended up in the hospital. That's the kind of one right way gone wrong. And you may be aware that the Netanyahu government has made numerous pledges to create a third space at the wall that they call the egalitarian space near a section called Robinson's Arch. And he keeps promising. Anat Hoffman and her group have even sued. They've won court judgments. He says he'll do it. They hold meetings. There's promises for 2 or 3 years, and then it doesn't happen. And why doesn't it happen? Well, Netanyahu is 16 years in power, and like most parliamentary democracies, the prime minister is in power because they have a majority in the legislature. That's not like American democracy. And there are maybe 24 political parties there. So no one of them is large enough to claim a majority. And that means he has to put together a coalition of many political parties. And from that, he includes some of the very ultra-Orthodox parties. So if he builds this egalitarian section of the wall, the ultra-Orthodox parties are going to be mad at him, and his coalition will fall apart, and he'll be out of power. So there's a place where you see the religion and politics interacting. There are also divisions in the Islamic world. I have to say I'm not as deeply familiar with them as I am with Judaism and Christianity, but you have the Sunnis and the Shia, which I'm sure you've heard about around the conflicts in the Middle East, and the Sufis, who are the more mystical branch of Islam. Christians are also known to be terrible to one another. There's a history of persecution of Christians on Christians all over the world, but especially in Israel. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is considered one of the most holy places for all of Christianity, is in the old city of Jerusalem, which is divided into four quarters. An Armenian Orthodox quarter, a Christian quarter, an Arab quarter, and the Jewish quarter. Now, how did that come to pass? That Church of the Holy Sepulchre was mainly controlled by Greek Orthodox, Armenian, Apostolic, and Roman Catholic Christians. In the 19th century, they added Coptic, Ethiopian, and Syriac Orthodox orders. All have a little claim to a chapel or a section or an altar in that Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is thought to be the place where the crucifixion took place and the original burial took place. A lot of debate among archaeologists about all that, but that's what infuses it with such holiness for Christians. In 1192, there was so much fighting among the Christians over the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that the then head of the government, who was the Ottomans were in power at the time, Saladin, gave the keys to the door to a Muslim family who was charged with keeping the peace among all the Christians. And that holds to this day. A Muslim family has the keys to that church, and they control when it opens, when it closes, and who can go there and who can do what where. The fighting among these groups in 1757, it continued. It still continues today. The Greek Orthodox staged a takeover, which led the Ottoman Sultan to declare the status quo for the church, and that's where the four quarters of the old city were established. I just don't think this is history, though. In 2002, on a hot summer day, and it gets very hot in the summer there, a Coptic monk moved his chair, because it was sitting in the sun, to a shady place. And this was seen as a hostile act, and the resulting fracas hospitalized 11 people. In 2004, at a Greek Orthodox celebration called the Exaltation of the Cross, the door to a Franciscan Catholic chapel was left open, which the Greeks saw as disrespectful. And there were fistfights and arrests, but nobody was hospitalized on that occasion. So these things continue. Then you have other overlays in Israel as well. The Baha'i headquarters are in Haifa, which is in northern Israel on the Mediterranean coast. The Baha'i emerged out of Islam in the 1800s. Two fellows declared that they were prophets of a new unified religion that was going to unify all the religions. Now, since in Islam there is no prophet but Muhammad, that sort of declaration would normally get you killed. But they happened to be of royal families, so they were exiled and imprisoned in Acre, which is right across the bay from Haifa. That's how they ended up in Haifa. And the Baha'i do believe in respecting every religion, believing it's all from the same wellspring, and in the unity of not only all religions, but all races. The greater intermarriage we have among the races, the faster we'll get to world peace, and they believe that there will be one religion sometime. Well, that's pretty appealing. That's a pretty inclusive and peaceful approach. However, the Baha'i also will not abide gay and lesbian relationships. That's against their religion. So they, too, have a one right way problem. UUs, just so you don't think I'm going to leave UUs out of this. The UUs, as far as I can tell, I thought every religion had a base in Jerusalem or in Israel. And as far as I can tell, UUs do not. I'll tell you a story about a UU pastor in Minnesota. I joined a UU church when I was in Minnesota in the 1990s. And at one point, we were having some racial issues in the town that had to do with Ethiopian and Somali refugees who had come and some gang of young white guys that call themselves All-American Boys, and there was some conflict and violence. And I said to the UU pastor, you know, we should do a joint service with the Baptists. There was a black Baptist congregation in town. I had heard about the Presbyterians and the synagogue having a joint service, and I thought that sounded like a great idea. Let's do something, the UU church with the Baptists. And the pastor said, it was a she in this case, well, that, yeah, we could, but then I would have a problem with their theology. Okay, so does the problem with theology mean we can't worship with people? And I will tell you today, I'm going to get into that tizay. I can see I'm running out of time, so I have to rush here. But the tizay chant, the tizay community in southern France, was founded by a man who had both Catholic and Protestant roots. And they are firmly ecumenical in their approach. There are monks who live there, and they attract thousands and thousands of young people for tizay services, which are chant, like you heard, but maybe a half hour, even an hour of service with multiple chants. If you have ever listened to Buddhist chant or Gregorian chant as an aid to meditation, it's something like that. I fell in love with tizay while I was at Tantour. I want to tell you more about Tantour, but I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skim over a lot of this and just mention a couple of things that give me hope about what I saw there. And then also invite you, if you wish, I think it's the 14th of November, I'm going to give a talk at the Barnstable Senior Center in the afternoon. And if you want to hear more, you could come on that occasion. But I saw many, many Israelis who are as horrified by what their government is doing as many of us are horrified by what our government is doing. So I want to say one of the most important thing is that we rid ourselves of this habit of saying the Israelis this and the Israelis that. It's the Israeli government that's pursuing certain policies. And I saw many, many Israelis working hard to bring kids together around sustainability projects in the forests, young adults just to talk for a couple of hours and get to know each other because the society is so fragmented and segregated. In the schools, bringing Muslim, Christian, and Jewish students together. Lots and lots of efforts going on to try and resolve the issue there. And I could say some things about BDS, too, because I know that's something the UUs are really involved in. But I will tell you, I've heard people say that the BDS, boycott, divestiture, and sanctions movement hurts Palestinians more than it hurts Israelis. And since UUs don't have a base in Israel, I would really suggest that it's maybe time to get a base in Israel and get in there and find out a little more about how these things work on the ground. And I can tell you, in academia, it makes no sense to me at all. Some academic scholarly societies have tried to follow the BDS movement also, but meaning they don't want their associations to go to Israel and meet with scholars from Israel or allow the Israeli scholars to come here. That, to me, cutting off dialogue is probably the worst thing we could do.